Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. And our first story up today is a quick but delightful story about how owning a dog is influenced by your genetic makeup. In other words, it's in your DNA. This comes from a study done in Sweden. They have a twin registry in Sweden. So if you're a twin, you're in the registry. They had 35,000 twin pairs, some of them fraternal twins and some of them identical twins. And there appears to be a significant genetic variation to whether or not you're going to own a dog. This was published just recently in Scientific Reports. Basically, the researchers found that if you were identical twins, you had a much higher concordance. That means that both twins were much more likely to own dogs than if you were non-identical twins. And that takes care of the confounds about, well, I grew up with a really great dog and I always wanted, you know, Old Yeller back or whatever. So it's definitely there. It's in the genes. That also means that it's going to be somewhat hereditary. We are always fascinated with this idea of co-evolution, and the dog and human co-evolution is definitely one of the better ones. For those movie buffs out there and want to look at something on the topic, I'd recommend a movie that's been going around on my satellite called Alpha. Really well done. If, you know, somewhat, you know, well, let's just say some artistic license was at work in terms of collapsing time and the literal healing journey of the protagonist. That being said, really excellent movie that postulates that just get the right wolf cub, and before you know it, you've got a pack of hunting dogs. Well, let's move from that comforting and warm and fuzzy to something a little bit scary. And that's this study that was published about a week ago in the Journal of the American Medical Association about sunscreen. Some of you may have had questions about it. The study was a fairly good scientific design. They used 24 healthy volunteers, and they were randomly assigned to either a spray or a lotion sunscreen. The sprays contained avobenzone, oxybenzone, or octocrylate, and the cream contained the chemical Ecamsul, which is the one I'm least familiar with. Volunteers were asked to put their assigned sunscreen on 75% of their bodies four times each day for 4 days. Basically, everywhere but where your underwear would cover was what they were instructed. And of course, no one puts it on the top of your head, so it basically works out to about 75% of their bodies. They took 30 blood samples over 7 days, and they looked at how high the blood got in, how high the chemicals in the blood got, how long it took them, and how long they stayed around. All of the chemicals had substantial absorption into the bloodstream through the skin, and several of them reached above what are considered the safe levels by the FDA. Before we leave that, let me just say that when the FDA approved these chemicals, which was more than 20 years ago, the presumption that they acted on was that people would apply these to the total body surface very rarely, maybe the first couple of days they were on vacation, and that otherwise people would just be putting sunscreen on maybe their face and their neck and their arms. So the basic assumption for safety and the thresholds that were set up at that time were appropriate for the current, then current usage of sunscreen. But we've had some serious mission creep, and now people are instructed to use sunscreen all over and use it all day and every day and don't forget to reapply. And that sells a whole lot more sunscreen, so I'm sure there's been a little industry support for these recommendations, but these are recommendations from ostensibly neutral sources, such as the American Academy of Dermatology. And in the wake of the study, they're being, well, let's just say they're huffing and puffing a little bit, because nobody likes to back down on their recommendations and say, oops. So they're still doubling down on melanoma is worse than sunscreen levels. But here's the big take home from this. And this is something you can use because, hey, we are headed into that time of year. And I personally will be getting out the sunscreen and using it. The micronized titanium and the micronized zinc, well, we've already established those end up in the lymph nodes. So you really do have the calculus here of maybe laying down a little base of sun so that you don't have to put on sunscreen every day and you just put it on when you're going to be out for a long time. But whatever the case, this study definitively says stay away from oxybenzone. Oxybenzone was absorbed into the body in this study at about a 50 to 100 times greater concentration than any of the other three chemicals they tested. Oxybenzone's kind of been on the radar for a while. A study in 2008 by the CDC looked at urine samples and found that 97% of urine samples contained oxybenzone. It's been linked to lower testosterone levels in adolescent boys. Maybe not such a bad thing. Hormone changes in men and shorter pregnancies and disrupted birth weights in babies. But these are just links, and association does not equal causality. It is, however, one of the more potent contact allergens, and about 70% of people will have a positive patch test when tested in a lab. Another Swiss study found 85% of breast milk samples had oxybenzone. So you now wonder about what that's going to do in newborns, who, of course, are not a population group that gets studied particularly for chemical toxicity studies. And Hawaii, Palau, and Key West recently banned sunscreens containing oxybenzone and also something called octinoxidate because they cause coral bleaching. European Union recently banned oxybenzone completely and benzone completely and found a substitute that seems to work just as well. So, as things currently stand, I'm going through my medicine chest tonight and throwing away anything that's got oxybenzone in it, and I suggest you do the same. As far as other sunscreens are concerned, I think you need to use your own judgment. It is true that a blistering sunburn is a cancer risk. That's unestablished. That is unassailable. One single blistering sunburn in your life gives you a lifelong risk for melanoma. So don't push it, particularly early on. Consider using the zinc and titanium products. I'm really not so worried about zinc and titanium in my lymph nodes because, after all, we're putting like major lumps of titanium in people's hips and knees and have been doing so for many years, and allergies are actually quite rare. So they do happen. They are rare. I think that we'd like to see skin cancer be rare, and unfortunately, it's not. And it's one of the more common cancers that shortens your life because it tends to affect younger people. So I'm not gainsaying the idea that you need sunscreen. I am saying let's be smart about which sunscreen we don't use. Now, this definitely qualifies as news of the weird. Sniffing out Parkinson's. Paramedics are taught to spot the juicy fruit gum smell on the breath of diabetics. As a person who's done my share of gastroenterology, I can tell you that partially digested blood has a unique and pungent bouquet, really unmistakable once you've smelled it. Parkinson's disease is familiar to most of the audience. This is a movement disorder caused by neurodegeneration in the brain, and this degeneration leads to problems with coordinating movement, overall stiffness, and freezing of the individual's ability to move. Here's an interesting story about Parkinson's. There's a woman in Scotland. She's a retired nurse, and her name is Joy Milne. She has always had an extraordinary sense of smell. This condition is called hyperosmia. So she is the canary in the coal mine. She detects odors at levels that are imperceptible to most people, which could definitely be a blessing or a curse, but I imagine as a nurse, we'd have to call it a curse. However, in 1974, Mrs. Milne noticed a somewhat odd musky smell around her house that hadn't been there previously. Never did figure it out, and about 12 years later, her husband was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. And gradually over time, he got worse, which is the classic natural history here. And around the late 90s, Mrs. Milne began going to Parkinson's support groups, and she noticed something extraordinary. All of the people in the support group who had Parkinson's had the same musky odor that her husband had developed in 1974. So shortly after that, she reached out to some researchers and said, what's up with this? Is this real? And can we figure out what's going on? Perdita Barron of the University of Manchester in Britain collaborated with Mrs. Milne to figure out exactly that. Now, Dr. Barron already had to go on the fact that people with Parkinson's are known to overproduce sebum. Sebum is your skin wax. It's the stuff that you squeeze out when you squeeze out a blackhead and there's a white waxy substance. That's sebum. Ordinarily, it's released in small amounts. It melts and it just serves to produce a lubricant and keep your skin soft and help with its barrier function. So the research decided to look at sebum samples. They had 43 people with Parkinson's and 21 who were not, and they put them on gauze. They just taped a piece of gauze to the person's back for 12 hours or so, and then warmed them and ran them through mass spectrometry. They wanted to see whether there were different amounts of different volatiles contained in the Parkinson's. And Mrs. Milne was there as literally the smellotron. As soon as the substances were volatilized, she took a sniff, pressed a button when she smelled the Parkinson's odor, and the samples she identified were found on mass spectrometry in very, very high levels. There were four of them: pyrrolic aldehyde, hippuric acid, icosane, and octadecanol. And they were at very different levels than in the healthy group. They synthesized them and gave them back to Mrs. Milne in a blind test, and yes, indeed, they were responsible for the odor. Now, we don't have an electronic nose, but we do have mass spectrometry widely available, distributed at labs across the country. If this pans out, this could be an early diagnostic test for Parkinson's. To the clinicians out there who are listening, I screen for Parkinson's and other neurodegenerative disorders such as Alzheimer's by checking a person's sense of smell. First, we check the nose to make sure it's not stuffed up or highly allergic or inflamed. Then we have the person smell these scratch and sniff cards that can be purchased. And they are given four choices. For example, is this grass, peach, lemon, or whiskey? And, of course, those all have very distinctive smells. And a person who gets 3 out of 3 correct out of 3 trials is presumed to have normal smell. The protein deposits of beta amyloid and alpha synuclein, which are the hallmarks of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's respectively, first accumulate in the olfactory lobe and in the part of the frontal lower brain that is closest in connection to the olfactory lobe, the olfactory bulb. That's the first place where they start to collect. And that isn't a place where anything but smell is involved, and so you don't notice anything. However, given the latency established by Mrs. Milne's history, 1974 with the diagnosis 12 years later, it stands to reason that this change in sebum could very possibly be another early marker. So here's how I would implement it. Were there a test for these compounds available through commercial laboratories? I would screen people with a smell test, and if they failed, I would do the gauze test, collect some sebum, send it off for analysis, and see if they were beginning to show this Parkinson's disease pattern. We're going to start with David in Alaska because, A, he's a regular listener, so he'll hear this as soon as we put it out. And secondly, he needs to really act on this. So David writes, "Love you, Dr. Dawn. I recently went through an emergency root canal. I first had to have a drain tube put in through my jaw. I spent several days after the procedure extremely ill and had to stop the antibiotics. It struck me that my body was reacting to the large amount of poisons that were injected into my jaw as numbing agents. My question is, do you think I should restart and finish the antibiotics? Penicillin, 500 milligrams, and metronidazole, 500 milligrams. Thank you. I never miss a show." Well, David, I will definitely reach out to you to make sure you get this message. But yes, you really do need to finish the antibiotics because you don't want a persistent bacterial infection. And one of the problems with root canals, although they are very beneficial in some respects, there is a fairly substantial and percentage, you know, in the one, maybe in the under 10%, but that's, you know, still not insubstantial, number of people who get a persistent smoldering infection in the jaw. And this can be particularly dangerous in people who have osteoporosis and who are taking the bisphosphonates because the body has a hard time fighting the bone infection if you're taking bisphosphonates because the cells that are trying to get in there and crunch through the infection get killed by the deposited drug. So you really want to do everything you can to clear that bacteria from the area. I'll come back to your comment about the anesthetics, but you need to do this and you also need to protect your intestines. So how to do that? How to protect your microbiome while taking penicillin and metronidazole? And the first thing you need to do is you need to take probiotics at different times from the penicillin and the metronidazole. And that can get complicated. The second thing that you need to do, doses of probiotics, I should say, about 50 billion assorted organisms. And I always try, and this is rule of thumb stuff, folks, but try to get at least two or three different forms of bifidobacterium and two to three different forms of lactobacillus. And if you have the opportunity to purchase something that also has Saccharomyces boulardii, which is a beneficial yeast, you'll also have the benefit of not giving yourself a risk for Clostridium difficile, that infectious diarrhea caused by an overgrowth of literally the last bug standing after we use strong, broad-spectrum antibiotics. Even with all those potential risks, the benefit of treating the infection is far greater. And so you just sometimes have a rock in a hard place and you go with the one that's smaller. And that's what I'm saying to you. But I want to circle back around to what you said about the anesthetics, the local anesthetics. I've had some jaw surgery. I haven't had implants, but I've certainly had my share of root canals. And it's very hard for them to get me numb. As a result, I tend to get very big doses in order to get the onset. And I've looked into this, and it has to do with the liver enzymes that I have and the tissue enzymes that I have that activate the drugs and that deactivate it. So I activate them slowly. So it takes a long time to get numb. So I end up with too much because they keep, you know, they want to move me through that room. And then it takes me a long time to burn through it. This is particularly important with the types of anesthetics that are used in surgery, the so-called gas anesthetics. But when in the case of the sodium channel blockers, which is the class that lidocaine and marcaine are, it's really just a matter of they slow the membrane potentials. If you have high levels, you're going to feel sluggish, but they aren't super strictly speaking, toxic. So when I hear what you're saying, I'm wondering if a little bit of the toxicity you were experiencing might have been just hordes of dying bacteria releasing their bodies into your lymphatic system and your, hence your bloodstream. And you were just experiencing the illness that comes from having to dispose of a sudden influx of toxic bacterial garbage. So it was not wise to stop the antibiotics, and I want you to restart them again right away and finish them. You don't want the bacteria to get a toehold while you're taking a drug holiday. One last word about the inhalation anesthetics. I was talking just a moment ago about Parkinson's disease. And when my Parkinson's patients have to have general anesthesia, I've had a large number, actually, at this point over the years, so I must cop to the fact that I have confirmation bias and there is no placebo, blinded, controlled study, et cetera, et cetera. That being said, enough of my Parkinson's people have taken a dive in their function after this kind of general anesthesia that I urge them to avoid the entire class of halothane-related anesthetics and instead, where possible, opt for spinal anesthesia or local nerve block with a big dose of sedatives if they're freaking out, but try not to be intubated and be taken under with those gas anesthetics if you already have a neurodegenerative disease. If you have to, because something's got to come up, something's got to come out above the diaphragm, there's no other way. And like I said earlier, you got a rock, you got a hard pit, place, you pick the smaller one. You don't have a third option. This from Anonymous, and definitely dovetails really nicely with what we've been seeing this program. I always like when we get these resonances going on. Anonymous writes, thanks for being on the air again. I'm confused about probiotics and also prebiotics. I think I'm histamine sensitive. Some probiotics make me bloat, and whenever I bloat, it impacts my brain, and I can't think. Okay, so that's a leaky gut symptom. It's also a SIBO symptom, small intestine bacterial overgrowth. More about that in a minute. Some also give me a runny nose. Foods, of course, can also induce these, as I have many intolerances. Are there any lab tests that test for this histamine reaction? And when we're talking about the histamine reaction of bloating and brain fog and also runny nose, there are two types of blood test one would have to do. First of all, you would need to do tests for IgE, E for emergency. These are the wheeze and sneeze antibodies, and they are released in large quantities. Actually wandering around the bloodstream in large quantities. And when they encounter their target, they trigger the release of histamine from the mast cells. They're basically even sitting on the surface of the mast cells. And when they find their target, they open up a little zipper in the mast cell and out comes a lot of histamine and bradykinin and all sorts of other wonderful chemical signals that give you leaky blood vessels and itchy nerve endings. So you would want to check for IgE, but also IgG. Now, there's another kind of histamine reaction in the gut, and this happens when you have too many of the wrong bacteria, and you eat food that's high in an amino acid called histidine. Sounds close. Well, that's because it is biochemically close. And so histidine from food, which ordinarily goes through with no trouble, gets converted by the wrong bacteria into histamine. And many of us have high levels of a protein that breaks down histamine, and that's called DAME. But if you don't have enough, DAMO, diamine oxidase. If you don't have enough of diamine oxidase, then you can get flushing, facial flushing, and diarrhea with high protein foods. So if that's a symptom that you're experiencing, you have to start thinking about whether taking extra amounts of this enzyme would help. And certainly going on a low histidine diet will make a difference in the symptoms and help you clue in that you've got this problem. So the first thing for Anonymous, whose next question is, what probiotics should I be taking and what should I be avoiding? And my answer is, The first thing you have to do is figure out whether you're stomach acid deficient and that that's contributing to your bloating. And the second thing you need to do is figure out how, whether or not you actually have too many bacteria. Even probiotics can be a problem if they grow in the small intestine at higher than normal levels. And one of the chief symptoms of that is bloating. So the way you get that tested is through a breath test. You drink something that you can't break down that bacteria can, and you wait to see whether or not you're bloating in half an hour or an hour or 2 hours. And when, how long it takes to start bloating tells us where the highest concentration of the bacteria is. And that helps us figure out why you have this and what the best way to do to get rid of it permanently is. Often that's going to involve using stomach acid supplementary. Some people can get by with apple cider vinegar. Some people use bitters. But all of these things are designed to increase the production or replace your own stomach acid. And they make a big difference for early bloating. And they also help prevent recurrences of SIBO. Usually people have that problem, although sometimes people have back leakage from the colon. So down there where the appendix is, there's a little valve called the ileocecal valve. And people who have leaky ileocecal valves will actually have a migration of bacteria from the colon up into the small intestine, where there's lots of sugar and starch and everything, lots of fiber. And this makes for some very, very happy microbes and some very, very unhappy patients. First of all, you're not going to cure any of these things with just throwing more probiotics into the mix without clarity of intention and a diagnosis that's solid. So answering your question, how do you choose a probiotic? I kind of covered that earlier. You want at least two to three different strains of lactobacillus and two to three different strains of bifidobacterium. If I'm doing this for just general wellness, I generally target it about 25 to 50 billion. If I'm trying to repair and prevent after, during and after antibiotics, I'm usually going at about double or maybe three times that, depending on the individual. Another question from Anonymous. Are fermented foods good for everyone? Are there some people who are there some people should be avoiding who have certain conditions? Well, obviously, if you have an allergic reaction to a food, sauerkraut particularly has a lot of histidine. So if you've got that flush and diarrhea symptom, you don't want to be eating a lot of sauerkraut. But yogurt would probably work, as well as water kefir. And the main thing is, if you've got an overgrowth of bacteria and you take any kind of probiotic, you're likely to aggravate the condition, not help it. You'll need a different set of therapies to eradicate, and then we call it eliminate and re-inoculate in functional medicine circles. So our lovely anonymous writer also has been eating organic, healthy, pretty much exclusively vegetables. They have multiple chemical sensitivities, lots of food sensitivities, and hypermobility syndrome, which I'm presuming they refer to joint mobility here. And if you've got leaky gut and joint mobility, you need to worry about fungus and sensitivity to fungal toxins as well. So you definitely get dealt a tough hand at poker with all of these problems. Last paragraph, and there are really no comments about this except that I will pass this on to Jeffrey Bland, who is one of my personal heroes. Lastly, because of my leaky gut, I'm prone to fungus, candida, and parasites. These diagnoses and treatment from functional docs and naturopaths in the past have saved my life. And because you said on the air that you're friends with Jeffrey Bland, please pass this on to him. I think he founded Metagenics or is on the board. Yeah, both of those. Metagenics Ultraparex saved my life so many times. My brain could function optimally again when taking them whenever I had a parasite. Metagenics discontinued it, and I've not found an equivalent that works as well. The Metagenic Candy Bactan Sups do not. Okay, so what I would suggest you do, Anonymous, is write directly to Metagenics, to customer service, explain the situation, and ask if, since they've taken it off the market, they would be willing to give you the recipe, component recipe for the product that you said worked so well for you. I am confident that if you have the recipe and the relative amounts of each compound, it's basic compounding pharmacy at that point to put something together that would replace the product that's been taken off the market. And I really do want to put a pitch out in favor of compounding pharmacies, my friends, because if something's too strong or you need it as a liquid or you can't tolerate it in the form or you need a smaller dose and the pills are already too small to make smaller, you can have it compounded as a liquid. You can have it changed to different compositions. You can have, if you're allergic to a dye or something like that, or you want to avoid one of the compounds. We talked a little bit about concerns over magnesium oxide, which is present in almost all products. I'm myself not so worried about that, but one of my listeners was, and I respect anyone's concern because a lot of these things are going to affect somebody. And if it consistently affects you and you don't use it and you're fine and you use it and you get the problem back, a couple of cycles of that, I'd say it's pretty convincing to me that you probably don't want to do that. Stop hitting yourself in the head with a hammer, so to speak. So we're going to drop into a little bit of a longer one here. This is a recent paper that came out of the American Journal of Medicine. It's a review article, and it's talking about marijuana's effects on brain structure and function, and what do we know, and what should we do about what we do know. And, of course, with marijuana being legalized, we need to develop some parameters, and this review of the literature makes quite clear that there are some substantial changes that occur or don't occur in the brain during your late teens, depending upon whether or not you are a regular smoker of marijuana. Adolescents who smoke marijuana are twice as likely to smoke more marijuana and more likely to be chronic daily users than people who begin smoking cannabis at a later age. It's associated with a decline in short-term memory and cognitive function, school or work performance, mood disorders, and if you have a tendency towards psychosis, there's definitely association. I honestly think the people who have psychosis are probably smoking marijuana to try to treat themselves because causation has not been established. Just that they hang around in the same people doesn't mean that one is causing the other, and you don't know the direction of causality with association studies. Always important caveat. A recent study done in New Zealand was quite revealing. They evaluated the association between regular cannabis use, and they did long-term testing. Here's how they set it up. They had 1,037 individuals, and they were enrolled at birth into this study, and they were followed from birth to 38 years old. That's about as good a randomization as you can get. And the presence of cannabis was determined from interviews at ages 18, 21, 26, 32, and 38 years. They did neuropsychological testing beginning at the age of 13, which was prior to cannabis use in almost all the individuals, and then again, extensive neuropsychological testing at age 38 after the patterns of cannabis use had been established. They did their best to correct for co-founders, and what they found was regular use was a problem. It caused decline across all of the markers, and it was worse in those who began the use of cannabis as adolescents, which makes sense because their brains weren't fully cooked yet and still had growing and pruning to do. The brains mature by pruning back synapses, pruning back neurons, and developing in the space of the little neurons big sophisticated synapse networks of the other neurons. So you create a web basically between the neurons that are used actively, and the ones that aren't being used simply wither away to create space for all of the wiring. This one really jumped out at me when I was reading this study. There's an average 6-point decrease in IQ for from childhood and to adulthood in regular users who began in adolescence by the time they got to 38. Even stopping the cannabis completely did not fully restore the estimated decrease in function. So you came back some, but you didn't come back all the way for those who began use prior to the age of 21. So this pruning thing I'm talking about, this is part of normal physiology. That's why when people talk about, you know, suffering of an embryo, especially suffering of an embryo, it doesn't really make any sense because suffering is a sophisticated thing that requires a sense of self and a limbic system, and those things are barely developed at birth. They're definitely not developed at 6 weeks. So, you know, we're being kind of crazy here, but I think everybody knows that. Getting back to the brain development in marijuana, this pruning that occurs in the preteen and teenage years is important to build these complex networks so that you can do decision-making in adulthood. And the limbic system, which is your emotional brain, it's just below the cortex, matures prior to the gray matter and is dominant during the period that we commonly think of as middle adolescence. So you get problems with emotional link decision-making, impulsivity, risk-taking, and experimentation. And we classically associate this, oh, that's a typical teenager. Well, why is it typical? Because they've got the typical teenage brain. And the prefrontal cortex, which is the executive, what Freud might call the superego, isn't formed yet. It hasn't developed its ability to dominate decision-making. You also see changes in myelin in the brain and which tracts are most heavily myelinated. And the more myelin, the faster these pathways go. And so if it's a race between impulse and, maybe I better not do that because it could set fire to the house, well, whichever one wins is going to strike the match. So you want those higher centers and their connections to output behaviors to myelinate well and quickly. So we can see structural differences in the brains of adolescents who are regular marijuana users compared with non-users. The gray matter, the white matter, the limbic system, and the cerebellum are all variants from the non-users. They've got thicker cortices in parts of the brain, thinner temporal lobes, and their frontal cortex volume changes. In other words, the volume of the cortex is different in all sorts of different areas, the cortex, prefrontal cortex, parietal, amygdala, and hippocampus. They usually do less well than non-users on attention, memory, speed, visual, spatial functioning, and most particularly executive functioning. So they've kind of got a sort of low-energy ADD situation going on. These changes do revert partially if you stop, but they correlate quite highly with age and duration of exposure. So there we have the marijuana set up for the brain development. Now we have legalized marijuana in this state, and we also have an arms race in concentrating the stuff. So while marijuana from 20 years ago had 5% THC, typical marijuana now has 10%. Some of the other compounds, the pastes, and have very, very high levels. Waxes are very high. And this is getting scary now. If you check the urine of women who are pregnant, who are in a room where marijuana smoking is going on, you can pick up THC in their urine. So if you're and that would also, I'm sure, be true of children. So the contact high, well, it may also be contact developmental delay. And that starts to look very, very different than a simple recreational drug. We need to really think about restricting this to people over 21 and doing our very best through education to make that stick. The fact that it's easy to vape and easy to hide makes it more challenging. And essentially what we're going to have to do is work through parents and work through education and get to the kids in grade school and middle school before the peer pressure to smoke hits and just say, this will make you stupid. You know, we have proof this will make you stupider than you would otherwise be. And once you're 21, well, you're 21, you can make your own decisions. You've got a well enough developed prefrontal cortex that you can understand the idea of consequences, both adverse and positive, and you're less impulsive. The U.S. is going to begin a study. This starts this year. They've got a 10-year longitudinal study of 10,000 9 to 10-year-olds. They'll be doing brain imaging, following academic performance, doing genetic testing, and that's super important because there's probably a genetic variant that makes you much more vulnerable, and you'd like to know who those people are. And of course, they drop it into the lap of physicians. We need to be doing what we can to make sure that people have the information they need to make good risk-benefit decisions, and I'm doing my part right here, right now in River City, or Sun City, or Surf City, or whatever you want to call it, to make sure that you hear this loud and clear. This is really not something that you want the kids getting into. But before we go too far, let's just do a few upbeat stories, because I know that last one was kind of a bummer. So, you know, thinking about THC, I immediately went to food, munchies, fiber. And I want you to, first of all, hear this number, 25 to 29 grams a day of fiber is the optimum intake. Americans typically consume about 15 grams of fiber. So we need to get that fiber consumption up. Now, why? Well, there have been this was from the World Health Organization. They went through and analyzed more than 180 studies, 50 clinical trials ranging over 40 years. People who ate the most fiber were 15 to 30% less likely to die prematurely from anything than those who ate the least fiber. The heavy fiber consumers were also 16 to 24% less likely to have a stroke, develop heart disease, type 2 diabetes, or colorectal cancer. Think about that. If I had a pill that I could say it's going to reduce your risk of breast cancer by 25%, also diabetes, also colon cancer, also stroke, and it's only a dollar a day, you would like, that would seem like such a bargain. Probably at $10 a day, you'd be tempted if your insurance would pay for it anyway. Well, how about a drug that has no side effects? How about a drug that's only a little bit inconvenient because it's not just a single pill? It's kind of bulky. Fiber is kind of bulky. You can definitely get it into a smoothie. You can blend it into yogurt. You can drink a fiber beverage. Natural psyllium seed works. Oat bran, wheat bran. There's all kinds of fiber out there. And of course, the most obvious one is eating vegetables because they are chock full of fiber. So do the calculation. Are you getting your 25%? That's a minimum, by the way. They said 25 to 29. So get your fiber. It's going to make you live longer. And more on the subject of good nutrition. We've known for a long time that the cruciferous vegetables are associated with a lower risk of cancer from epidemiologic studies. But researchers at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center recently scratched a little bit deeper into the mechanism of that. They demonstrated that there's an ingredient in all of these cruciferous vegetables, but particularly broccoli sprouts, that isn't sulforaphane. We talked about that one last week. This one is called indole-3-carbinol, and it suppressed tumor growth in animals that were likely to develop cancer, that were genetically likely. This was published in, let's see, what's the date on this one? This was published in the May 16th issue of Science, which is like the first or second most prestigious publication there is and very tough to get into. And they further elucidated a pathway into cancer. And this one's really cool because this pathway isn't just a regulator for tumor growth control. It's also a potential actionable Achilles heel that we can exploit to kill cancer cells. Here's how it works. There's a very well-known potent cancer suppressor gene. It's called PTEN, PTEN. And when you get cancer, this is one of the most likely genes to disappear, be mutated, deleted, downregulated, or silenced by human cancers because it is a serious interference in being a cancer. Some people inherit a mutation in PTEN that causes them to have increased cancer susceptibility. But if you lose both copies of the gene, it pushes the dead man switch and the cancer cell halts proliferation and can't start and can't divide and dies. So the cancers can't eliminate the gene entirely or they would die. So what they do is they weaken it. They exhibit lower levels. And the question is, since the tumor cells are doing that so they can grow rapidly, could we restore PTEN to its former puissance and knock the cancers out of the ring? Well, there is a gene called WWP, which produces an enzyme that inhibits the PTEN's tumor suppressive activity. If you give indole-3-carbinol, that gene is deactivated, and the cancer's ability to deactivate PTEN is substantially impacted. So they tested this in laboratory animals, and they have found it to be extremely helpful. I have been recommending indole-3-carbinol for different reasons related to its activity for detoxification in any breast cancer or hormonal cancer patient that I've had. And I think it's time for us to broaden that in the wake of this study and start recommending it for all cancer patients. A few stories about obesity and insulin resistance. We're going to start off with this first one. It's based on Ramadan. The research was done in Baylor College of Medicine, United States. The head researcher is Mindikoglu, and she's an associate professor of medicine and surgery. She did a pilot study looking at what happens during Ramadan. This is a Muslim festival in which people fast from dawn to sunset for 30 days, and then they eat all of their calories in the evening. So 15 hours a day with no food. Given they were great lab animals, the researchers collected blood samples from the individual before beginning the fast and after the fourth week of fasting, and then again 1 week after the fasting was over when they were eating back to normal. They found increased levels of a protein in the blood called tropomyosin. Actually, there is tropomyosin 1, 3, and 4, and they all have a role in maintaining cell repair, and they're important also in the body's response to insulin, especially tropomyosin 3. So the study showed that there was an increase in tropomyosin 3 gene protein products between the beginning of the fast and the test 1 week afterwards. And so this is promising, the idea that maybe we can restore insulin sensitivity in people who are pre-diabetic by having them go on a fairly brief fasting program. It'll be interesting to see whether they could get by with using a ketogenic diet and see those same levels if they just only consumed fat during the day. I have several patients on very highly ketogenic diets that are doing very well with their diabetes, astonishingly well. Generally, we're starting something this radical for very strong reasons, often as part of a comprehensive complementary treatment in someone who's receiving cancer chemotherapy. We don't really want them to lose a lot of weight, and we don't want them to eat a lot of sugar. So using fat is a really effective strategy for this. So the next thing is talking about the influence of light on insulin sensitivity. We already know that the body's circadian rhythm influences the effects of many drugs. We've known for a long time, for example, that chemotherapy agents, if they are given in the evening, are often more effective because the person doesn't eat for the next 12 hours. And so as a result, the effect of the chemo is more potent. That's what we thought it was. But it may also be because drugs are broken down differently and have different properties in the body depending on what time of the day. So the secretion of several hormones, including insulin, varies over a 24-hour period. And the body synchronizes itself via two essential elements, the alternation of light and darkness and the alternation of feeding and fasting. So the light perceived by retinal neurons is transmitted to the brain and it affects the body clocks. And this, and there's a place in the ventromedial hypothalamic nucleus that has a direct neurological connection to skeletal muscle. Basically, it has a nerve that goes out of the hypothalamus and goes down through the sympathetic nervous chain into the muscles, and it regulates insulin action in muscle tissue. And what they found was if they mess with the light-dark cycle, they affect this signaling and they reduce just a single hour of light in the middle of the dark signal, effectively reduced the insulin sensitivity a substantial amount. It's also true that if you just put the animal in the dark for 2 days, you get the same increased insulin sensitivity. So think about that for our cave dwellers who are inside indoor light in the dot-coms working 14 to 16 hour days, sleeping under their desks. I know it sounds crazy, but people actually behave this way in startups, running down to grab food because there's always an unlimited kitchen in these places, and just giving themselves shift worker syndrome and potentially setting themselves up for insulin resistance. And I see such aging there. I really want to emphasize how important it is to take care of yourself and get your sleep. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.